Today's episode of the Mikvah Podcast is brought to you by Pella Windows and Doors. I'm looking out my window right now, and we are in a full-fledged blizzard. We're in a full-fledged blizzard, and if it's cold outside, and if you're feeling cold inside, that's not good. You know what you need to do? You need to talk to your local Pella Omaha and Lincoln expert about taking a closer look at your windows. You can save energy and stay warm even during a blizzard when it's freezing outside with windows from Pella that are properly installed the patented Pella way by professionals using window and doors with the highest energy efficiency ratings in the industry from Energy Star. Check them out online, PellaOmaha.com. That's PellaOmaha.com. And the Nick Bob Podcast is brought to you by my friends at Runza. Listeners of the podcast, you guys know I'm a hip-hop fan. That's why when it's time for me to get my lunch game right, I crank up the Runza DMC, which stands for the Runza Delicious Meaty Combo. I get my Runza sandwich with a little cheese in that thing. I pair it up with the best crinkle fries on the planet. Polish it off with a beverage colder than the ice in Mitch Ballack's veins. That's the Runza DMC, the Delicious Meaty Combo. Get to Runza today. Get yours. Tell them your friend Nick Baugh sent you. Okay, it is Monday, January 25th. And I haven't talked to my old pal, John Niatawa, the Omaha World Herald. I haven't talked to him on the podcast yet since hoop season has started. He's obviously the Creighton beat writer, a guy that I've known for, gosh, almost a little over a decade now. Always enjoy talking hoops with John. And he covers this team, this Blue Jay team, very closely, knows this team inside and out. And I really wanted to kind of pick his brain on, you know, where we're at with this squad right now. We're 15 games in. Creighton had they finally got off the losing schneid here of losing a couple games in a row. They took down UConn over the weekend. So the Jays are sitting at, 11-4 right now, with big aspirations as the calendar is going to turn to February and ultimately March. So there's certainly a lot to talk about with the Creighton Blue Jays right now. So let's get to it. Here's my podcast chat. Creighton beat writer John Niatawa. Enjoy. Right on the line now, Creighton Blue Jay beat writer John Niatawa, one of my favorite guys. I always enjoy it. John, I love talking basketball with you. You got a great basketball mind, and I love it. I always feel like you and I had a long talk after the, I think it was the Nebraska game, about like Creighton recruiting and all that stuff. You and I just stumble into like deep conversations with basketball. That is, I thoroughly enjoy it, and it's been a long time. So welcome back to the podcast, and how are you, my friend?
Yeah, this is probably good, Nick, because like I think my wife's getting tired of me like throwing out theories of, oh, you know, I wonder if Creighton can do something different with his ball screen coverage, or maybe there's a way, different way of Creighton can attack the help side defender. She's like, what are you talking about?
I don't know what you're saying.
And I'm like, I actually don't know if I know what I'm talking about. That's right. The problem. That's
isn't that funny?
You, Nick, you can kind of set me straight. Well. Your expertise. By the way, can I give you some praise? What game were you on? The Butler game, Creighton Butler.
Oh, yeah.
I thought you did a great job.
Thank you.
Giving some insight to the Creighton fans, mostly about the pace and the impact that pace can have. Not just, obviously, transition is it's key for Creighton to score in transition, but when they're moving the way they are capable of on offense in the half court, it can really put teams in bind. So,
yeah.
Always enjoy you. You're inside on games. So there's my
there we go. Hey, we're patting each other in the back. Yeah, I like it. I want to start with this, and I want to obviously I think you and I are both really high on this team, and we think a lot of we think a lot of the coaching staff, we think a lot of this this group. But I really think this team can achieve historic things for the program. I really believe that. But let me just because I don't even know how I feel about this, but I just kind of want to like use you as a sounding board. At the same time, John, so we're 15 games into the season. And I would say that Creighton has only looked elite for like 2.5, maybe 3 games. Like second half against Nebraska, the Seton Hall game at home, the St. John's game at home. You could maybe throw the St. John's game on the road. You could maybe throw like the first half of Marquette in there, but been a ton of grinders and they've won them, which is great and significant progress, but help me make sense of that. And I don't know if you feel that same way. Like if we really are being honest, like they've really only looked like that, you know, like you think about last year's DePaul game or the Butler game or certain times where they just were like a buzzsaw. And maybe we've created this unrealistic expectation that every single time they come out, they're going to score 100 points, hit 18 threes, and just have, you know, spectacular offensive basketball on display. But dude, help me kind of make sense of that.
No, I feel like you're not wrong in your assessment. And sure, there's some of last year that's like bleeding into our perception of what this team is or can be, but I don't think that's inaccurate. Or I feel like Creighton returned a lot of pieces, right? So like the core group of what Creighton had last year and how it finished the season, like that group is back. So I don't think that it's you're off base to make those types of conclusions and kind of apply, you know, some thoughts and analysis and assessments of last year to this year's group and compare. You know, the pandemic's made things weird.
Yep.
So perhaps that's part of it, just in terms of they didn't work out together during the summer and their preseason was disjointed. So maybe that's part of it. But, you know, if last year didn't happen, Nick, I think that I'd be at this point in the season just be thinking like, okay, Creighton, you know, the ceiling's maybe not as high as I thought it would be. You know, they've shown that they can win in different ways, but they just haven't been consistent, and that's just who this team is. But last year kind of proved that if they can find something and find a groove and settle into roles and sort of listen to their coaches and buy into what they're saying, like they can get better rather drastically. Because at this point last year, we weren't thinking that Creighton's going to win the Big East.
True. That's a good point.
I wasn't.
Yeah, no, I wasn't either. Right, right.
The Big East, going to be in line for a 2 seed. I was thinking more like Creighton might be on the right side of the bubble right now, but it has work to do to get in the NCAA tournament.
That's a good point.
I'm just not sure if it's there yet.
Yeah.
And so that track record of improvement, maybe you can apply that to this year's team and we'll see where they're at in 10 games. Because like, and I think that's what's so tantalizing for Creighton fans is they've seen these glimpses, like you mentioned pretty much all of them, where they've looked really good. And given what we saw from this group last year, like, well, they can definitely replicate that on a more consistent basis because they did it.
Right.
So I think that's probably the encouraging part. But yeah, like it's taken a little bit longer than I expected, considering all the pieces that are coming back. You'd think that they would have been able to kind of pick up with where they left off a little bit faster than others, but there's been some other circumstances that have led to a little work in progress for them.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, they are 11-4, and you know they could have won every single game they've lost. In fact, you could say if they just made free throws. I mean, something as simple as like if they just make free throws, they could be undefeated right now. So at the same time, that's also maybe if you want to look at it from the other perspective, like, man, they haven't even necessarily like really started humming, and they're still winning games, which is good. But yeah, I mean, I think the Duke might not make the NCAA tournament. Kentucky is like a bad basketball team right now. North Carolina isn't ranked inside the top 25. And then even when you look at football, like Michigan was bad this year. Penn State was bad this year. Like the pandemic, the pandemic and all that goes into it, I think we have to acknowledge on some level makes an impact. And I wonder also too, John, how much like no fans at games makes an impact for a team like Creighton, because there were so many times that it feels like when Creighton would maybe kind of get rolling, maybe that 7-0 run turns into a 13-2 run or whatever, you know, and without fans, maybe that's a factor too.
Well, and I think you're kind of onto something, because when Creighton was really good last year, because of its scoring threat and potential potency offensively, like it put teams on their heels. Like mm-hmm. they knew, uh-oh, 2 threes in a row, like we got to go, because if we don't, Creighton's gonna, this 6-point lead is going to turn into a 12-point lead in a hurry, and you kind of felt that pressure to keep up with Creighton, and that played into Creighton's hands, because then you start making mistakes and it kind of snowballs in a negative way. I mean, there's many instances last year of that happening, and the crowd plays into that. Like, I think Creighton's runs just haven't been as dynamic, and maybe that's just because they haven't hit as many threes this year. They've been a little bit more hot and cold from the 3-point line than they were last year so far. But I do think the crowd impacts it. Like,
yes, it does.
Providence getting off to a 23-6 start. Like, I don't think that happens.
I don't either.
For the full arena. You know, like, some of the way Marquette roared back in the second half against Creighton on its home court, you know, like, I think that it's Creighton's home court advantage is so significant. And I spent the summer sort of analyzing the portion of the summer analyzing, like, Creighton's plus minus at home versus the road versus on the road last year was unreal. I wish I had the number for you off the top of my head, but it was just insane.
Yeah.
When you look at how much better they were at home versus the road. And I think, yeah, the fan support and the atmosphere of that building. I mean, I think that the moment that it really stuck out more than anything was when Seton Hall decided that they couldn't play their normal style of game and win at Creighton in the final game of the season last year. Like, they had to slow the tempo down. And I think that was a salute to and a sign of respect to what Creighton is capable of in a jam-packed building with that offense the way it's rolling. So, yeah, it's definitely had an impact for sure.
Yeah, I just, you know, you think about the end of last season. I'll never forget, so you remember the Butler game at the end of the season as well. I want to say it was like late February. And I remember I did that game on TV, and I went back to the locker room and I talked to LaValle Jordan before the game. And I remember I'm sitting down, I'm in the coach's locker room, and, you know, he doesn't have his tie tied yet. He's just sitting there. And I go, so how you feel about today? And he gives me a look like, we're about to get our ass kicked. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he was like, we are in trouble. He goes, that team, and he pointed at the other guy, goes, that team is scary right now. And right. I just, and I remember kind of like thinking to myself, I'm like, yeah, y'all are in trouble today, you know? And it was like a matter of time. And I just, like, again, other than the St. John's game at home, other than the Seton Hall game at home, other than the second half of Nebraska, like, I just haven't felt that, you know? I haven't felt that, like, where it is just scary for long stretches offensively. And I guess for me, as much as we want to, because I think everything we just laid out is a factor, but I think the ultimate factor is Marcus Zegarowski. The reality is, John, I think it all comes back to him. Like, until he fully regains his groove, in my opinion, this is going to be kind of who Creighton is. They're a little bit vulnerable. They're a little bit inconsistent. They're harder to hit those, like, high highs offensively. Because I just don't think – people need to remember, like, for the final month of the season last year, he was arguably the best guard in the country for the final month of the season last year. And so what are you seeing with Marcus right now? Because I think I've said it for basically since he's been here, he is so tied to Creighton's success. Like, Creighton goes as he goes. Like, when he plays well, Creighton plays awesome. When he struggles, Creighton struggles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought he played really well against UConn. He just didn't hit shots. He's 1 of 5 from three, but I thought he was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was, you know, just because, well, I mean, RJ Cole made life tough on him.
Yeah. And UConn's really good defensively. I think people need to realize, like, yeah, they didn't have Book Knight, but, like, that's, like, one of the better, that's one of the 20 best defenses in half-court defenses in the country to me.
And they have things that make it tough on Creighton because of their length. And those big men, their ability to hedge on ball screens. I mean, we talked about Creighton and Christian Bishop's ability to do it, Martin Crumple before him. How they can hard hedge and really force your ball handler out and back and out and back. Like, they're good at that. And they got a couple turnovers in the first game when Creighton got a little too casual with the ball in those ball screen situations. So, like, it's hard. I think it's hard against UConn to find a rhythm, but I thought Marcus did a really good job in that game. And I feel like I saw more and more flashes of the old Marcus.
Agreed, especially late. I thought late in the game, I thought Marcus showed a few.
Well, I was going to say, even before UConn, like, Seton Hall, Providence, and like that Providence game, like, I think he's getting there. And the message from him and Coach McDermott since the start of the season was like, he needs some reps.
Yes.
He needs some live reps, and he didn't get a lot during the preseason or the offseason because he's either rehabbing or Creighton was taking a break or not doing 5-on-5, easing its way back into it. So it was just going to take time. And so you're right. A lot of Creighton success is tied to Marcus. And, you know, his playmaking ability. It's interesting, Nick. Let me ask you this real quick, because like what I've noticed over the last three-ish games, and I'm sure it's happened before, but it's really stood out to me, is how committed opposing defenses are to not helping. So yeah. Like when Creighton's guys drive, they stick like glue to the shooters. And like, sure, teams have always tried to do that, but I mean, we're talking like back to the ball,
right? You know, yeah. like on penetration, they're working further out to the shooters rather than even like sinking in at all. Right.
Yeah. Right. And so what it's led to is a lot of, I mean, Creighton's eighth in the country in 2-point shooting percentage. Mm-hmm. So like it's led to a lot of twos and a lot of good looks inside, but it's also kind of like disrupted a little bit Creighton's sort of drive and kick, make a play for a teammate, you know, get in the lane, jump stop, and let the ball sort of move, because when they drive, it's like, dude, I could just score, you know, like yeah. There's no defense here. I can hit a short jumper or get all the way to the rim or get to the foul line. So I wonder now from Marcus's standpoint, like, I mean, you do that too often with Marcus, like he's just going to drop 30 on you. Like yes, that's a Texas right. Tech game.
Yep.
From a year ago when he settles in, you can't do that all game. And I think Providence was a little bit more conscious of when he drove, but I do think there's some adjustment there for Creighton. But then again, here's the other thing too. Like, it's hard for defenses to do that. That's like not what you're trained to do in the man-to-man system. Right. It's like, don't help when that driver has a lane to the bucket. So I'm curious to see it. Well, first off, have you noticed that?
Yeah, I have.
Do you think it's sustainable? And what kind of counters can Creighton come up
yeah,
with? Yeah,
I have noticed that. And to be honest with you, like if I were going against Creighton, I would do the same thing. I would say, listen, they're going to shoot twos the whole game. If they beat us making shooting 65% from two, whatever. Like what we're not going to do is allow them to make rhythm kick threes the whole game, because that's obviously what they want to do. So, to a certain extent, I think two things. I think number one, you do kind of just got to take what the defense gives you. I mean, if Marcus Zagorowski drives in there and he's got a 10-footer, like, take it, you know? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But this is where I think pace comes back into it. Like, it's harder to do that when you're pushing it in the open floor, the early offense. And I think a lot of people, and I try to make this point on TV, I think a lot of people think when they think of pace, they think of a primary, you have numbers, fast break. Like a 3-on-2 or a 2-on-1. Yeah, that is playing fast. But I think even just playing and attacking early in a possession, it gets harder, John, to like be totally organized defensively where everybody's matched up, everybody is kind of locked into what they're doing. I think that's where playing faster early in possessions, you could land into someone making a mental mistake or an open three early. So I think it's two things. You got to take if they're giving you good twos, take them. But I also think right. that's where the relentless pushing of the basketball, you can land into threes early in possessions.
Well, and then the other thing, it's like Creighton took 23s against UConn. I mean, how many of those were bad shots? Those were all like, most of them were good looks.
I just wrote that down. I think however many
they had against Providence and
right.
Butler. I mean,
great
I'm
looks.
Rewatching these games, and I'm just like, wow.
Right. You know,
like,
right.
You take that all day.
Right.
So even though teams are trying to, at least those three opponents were trying to avoid, you know, giving Creighton opportunities on the 3-point line, they still got them because they, you know, this offense is, you know, with the space and the pace that you mentioned, like, it is tough to stop it all. And, so now it's just up to Creighton hitting those shots. But.
No, you're so right, though, because I wrote that down. And, you know, we say, like, man, the offense hasn't quite been as potent and this and that. Like, I still feel like every game Creighton gets great shots, like great open threes, good shots at the rim, drives. Like, the ease at which they find quality shots is just – they make it look easy. Like, yeah. You watch other teams run off it. Like, I did DePaul and Marquette the other night. And it was like, oh, my God. Like, it felt like it was really hard for either team to get a quality look, you know? And, like, then you watch Creighton play, and it feels like the court is, like, bigger or something like that. Like, there's just way more space on the court. And every shot, I'm like, that's a good look. You'll take that. Yeah, that's a good shot. So as much as we're kind of saying, oh, man, what's the deal? They're not, like, necessarily murdering people offensively. It's like, well, they're getting good shots. And I think Coach McDermott tell you, like, that's all you can really do is just try to get a quality shot and trust that over the course of time, it'll all work itself out.
Yeah, and they've got good shooters, obviously. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, like, I mean, in terms of what they're shooting right now, but Mitch and Marcus are plus 40 in their careers. Denzel Mahoney shot 38% from three in Big East play last year. So, like, that's a big enough sample size to say, okay, he's reliable from there to hit open shots. And Damian Jefferson's obviously improved his shooting. So, like, he can knock it down. Same with Sharif Mitchell. And Alex O'Connell has a track record of shooting well. And Antoine Jones has made a lot of strides as a shooter. So, like, they have plenty of guys that if you leave them open, Creighton's comfortable taking that shot. It's just they've just been, like, really hot and cold. And that was, like,
right.
One of the things about last year's team that was so impressive when you look at their shooting percentages, particularly from three, like, they had maybe four off nights in Big East play from a shooting perspective from three. Like, it was unreal. And two of them came, like, at the start of the season with Butler and Nova. I mean, after that, they were just like,
they were so steady
every night.
Yeah. You
know?
Right.
So this year's team has kind of been more, you know, they bombed shots against Marquette and splashed a ton against Seton Hall in the two St. John's games, but the other games, they haven't been as good. And so I think the looks, as we've stated, like, I don't think the looks have changed. It's just a matter of them hitting it. So, as Coach McDermott said, and I tend to agree with him here because we've seen what these guys can do over time, it'll work out. They just got to keep getting these same shots.
Let's talk about Mitch for a second. I mean, because, you know, it's weird. I had someone tweet at me who was like, listen, I love Mitch and so do you, but everyone talking up his unselfishness has made him too unselfish, all this stuff. And it's like, okay, you know, I mean, I think a lot of that's just how he's wired. But I also think, like, there's a difference between being unselfish and unaggressive. And I look at Mitch right now. I think Mitch is unbelievably unaggressive to score. Like, this is the most unaggressive I've seen him in his career. Like, he's not hunting his own shot. Every single time he drives, he's driving to pass. He is never driving to finish. And it reminds me of the old Larry Brown line that he gave Danny Manning in the 88 national title game. He said, there's a fine line between selfishness and responsibility. And I just look at a guy like Mitch and I'm like, you know, you think of that Butler game, Mitch can't play 40 plus minutes and basically be a non-factor. Like, he's too good of a player. He's too skilled and too good of a scorer to be like that. And again, like, I love his unselfishness. And I think it's a huge part of what makes Creighton great. But, like, I just think he needs to increase. I think he can be aggressive and be unselfish at the same time.
Yeah. And with the way that teams have been playing Creighton, as we've kind of discussed lately, they've been so glued to him on the three-point line that he hasn't got a lot of looks from distance, not a lot of catch and shoots, you know. And when he has driven, the defense hasn't collapsed to him. They've kind of, even if he's had the advantage where it looks like he maybe has his hip ahead of the guy or he's got an angle to the rim, they're not bringing help. And so, yeah, I think you're right that he can be a little bit more aggressive. And I feel like you saw it. He had that big bucket against UConn late. He scored against Providence with like 2 minutes left to pull within two. Like, I think in his head, he's starting to process it a little bit more of that fact. Like, the coaches are on him and they know, but now that he's experienced it, he sees what, you know, the downside of it is, because obviously he's more apt to pass and create for others than to look for himself. But if teams are going to play Creighton like that, like, they're going to need guys to just step up and be aggressive and go to the rim. And, you know, Denzel Mahoney and Damian Jefferson and Zagorowski are not, they're not going to hesitate to do it. So now it's up to Mitch to take advantage of a matchup if he has one and go to the rim and or go inside and try to score. I think it's like, so that it's weird with him in that we've seen him play for so long, right. So we kind of know this, but like he doesn't a lot of, like you said, he drives sometimes and is you can tell he's not even thinking. Like,
he's not even looking at the hoop, John. Like, no, he's truly not. He's
play,
not even looking at the basket.
Butler where it was like shot clock was winding down and he threw a lob and it ended up hitting the rim. And I was like, dude, just shoot the floater.
Just go. Like, yeah. I guess
you're open.
For me, he's right now for certain games, like for whatever reason, Kevin Willard is convinced that like, the key to Creighton's team is Ballack. Like, he did it in both Seton Hall games last year, especially at their place where they are just, like, they basically, like, face guard him, right?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of teams that are doing that. So, he's getting the Ethan Rogge treatment. Remember how Rogge, like, it got to where after he had all those threes at Nova, teams just started face guarding him. He's getting the Rogge treatment, but Rogge wasn't capable. And I love Ethan, but, like, Rogge wasn't capable of countering that. Like, his game just, like, he wasn't a great passer. He couldn't put it on the deck. Like, he created a ton of space, but, like, there was nothing he could do to counteract that. See, Mitch is way more well-rounded than Rogge is. Like, Mitch can drive it. Mitch can go finish. Like, I just would like to see, I just think his aggressiveness needs to increase a little bit, and I think he can balance that aggressiveness without sacrificing any of that unselfishness, you know?
Yeah, and I think, I think it will, Nick, man, because, like, they lost two in a row,
right?
And everyone has had to make some sort of assessment of what he's doing and how he can contribute, and, you know, Mitch is as conscious of that as anyone in terms of, like, how can I help this team? And you know, unselfish, like that quote you referenced about unselfishness versus responsibility, it's like it almost is selfish a little bit to
it kind of is
passing.
It's selfish for because him to not be aggressive.
Your duty to the team is to to make a play, and even that means a shot that maybe is a little bit in your outside of your comfort zone, like a leaner or a driving bucket. That's, you know, he's worked on a lot of that stuff, but you know, he's obviously most comfortable firing away from three, but sometimes that's what the situation calls for. And so I think he's gonna, I mean, because I feel like I've seen signs, but now he's just got to do it a little bit more consistently and not allow, like, when teams are face guarding you, I feel like, isn't this what happened to Marcus Foster, like in the K-State game,
mm-hmm.
In the NCAA tournament? They like face guarded him and were really physical and took him out. Like, eventually, he just kind of was like a statue,
right?
You know, like he
it makes you just
want to
stand there. You know, like, okay,
and
well, if you're not going
to
step off,
that's
me,
what Mitch has
right.
to avoid.
Right, and he's got to avoid that. But yeah, it's
like he can space him drawing the defender opens things up for other guys.
Oh, God,
yeah, but. You don't want to spend the whole game doing that because obviously he can contribute in other ways.
I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, there's no question. Even like, he still is making an enormous impact because he's creating so much space and opportunities for the other guys to score. But I guess what I'm saying is I just think there's so much more even on top of the space that he's creating that he needs to create. And I just think of, like, you know, whether it's Duncan Robinson, thinking about how he played. Like, Duncan is, like, hunting. But at the same time, Duncan Robinson will come off a handoff, and if two guys jump at him, he'll drop it down to Bam Adebayo. Or, like, Steph is hunting. But same thing. If two guys run at him, he drops it to Draymond Green or skips it opposite to, you know, Wiggins or whoever. Like, I just think, like, you can do both. Like, you can be relentless in your pursuit of finding a shot, but also still make the right play. And for whatever reason, I just feel like Mitch isn't, like, quite finding that balance right now.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's hard, though. Like, teams do have, like, Butler put Aaron Thompson on him.
Right, right.
I was like, oh, that's one of
that's the respect
in the league. So,
right.
I mean, if you're Creighton, you're kind of like, well, that's a tough matchup for Mitch to get a – so, you know, I think about, well, that was the first half against UConn, I think, where Creighton does that little hit and chase. It's kind of like a handoff.
Yep.
They call it a hit and chase. Like, a handoff with a big man who hands the ball off to a guard and then screens that guard's defender really quick. And they kind of just play cat and mouse a little bit. I feel like Mitch and Christian, I think, was the guy who it was setting the screen. Like, Mitch was running around this dude
right.
for like 5 seconds, trying to get free. And he eventually did get free for a three and he missed it. But I was thinking watching that, I was like, gosh, it is so hard for him to get open because like teams are putting good defenders on him.
Right.
Athletic guys that, or maybe getting away with some grabs or some physicality, but it's Big East play, so you got to roll with it. So I say all that to say, but still, you know, they need more.
Yeah, no, I totally understand.
So they need him to put forth that effort every time. Well, not every time, just obviously there's other options, but like there are certain times in the game where he has to be that aggressive, where it takes like five moves to break free and get a shot. So.
Right. And yeah, it's just it's an interesting situation for him right now. And because he is, I just think last year you saw way more drive and he had a lot of drives and finishes at the rim last year. Way more than you think he would. And I just don't think he's getting a lot of that right now because he's just not really looking for it. And again, he's still making an enormous impact, but they need him to kind of go to another level offensively to me. But what's kind of amazing, we talk about like referencing last season, and even, I mean, this group's been together for a couple of seasons now. The thing that's pretty amazing to say out loud is if you hadn't watched this team for the past couple of seasons, you'd think Damian Jefferson is Creighton's best player by a mile. Like you would think Damian Jefferson is the preseason conference player of the year. Like he's the guy, you know, like he has been so stinking good this season. Like what has stood out to you with his year? Because it's been remarkable how good he's been.
Yeah. And honestly, the reason why, in my opinion, the reason why UConn got back in the game at the end of the first half was Damian Jefferson was in foul trouble, wasn't out there. Creighton's offense stalled a little bit, had maybe some breakdowns on defense. They missed him. They missed him a lot. His ability to get in the paint and finish, honestly, put the ball on the floor and make smart decisions, make reads, just reacting to the defense. Now he's like, we've spent all that time talking about Mitch, like Damian Jefferson is the main beneficiary of
1,000%
all the attention the teams are placing on stopping Mitch, because a lot of times they'll get, I don't know, the worst defender.
Let's take a quick break to talk to you about my longtime pals and loyal supporters of the podcast, Pella Windows and Doors. You know, Pella has a window type for every home and every budget. And you might know Pella for its award-winning wood windows, but did you know that Pella also has a complete line of industry-leading patented fiberglass and vinyl windows? Pella's fiberglass windows use a patented Duracast material, more durable than aluminum or vinyl, made from a composite material used in the aerospace industry for its strength, durability, and temperature resistance. It's big time right there. And Pella's vinyl window series offer all the features that make it one of the most energy efficient windows on the market, with the same value and style you've come to expect from all Pella products, with outstanding structural integrity, built from multi-chambered, fully welded frames and sashes. Pella's vinyl windows assure a quieter, more comfortable home. Bottom line, Pella's vinyl and fiberglass windows are really, really cool. Check them out online, PellaOmaha.com. That's PellaOmaha.com. And while we're here, let's talk about my good friends at Runza. Got another super secret menu item not a lot of people know about. My friends at Runza are hooking me up, and I'm going to let you in on it. This one's just, this one's near and dear to my heart, because it's a twist on the best fries on earth. Runza's Crinkle Fries. It's Runza's Chili Cheese Fries. That's some legendary Runza Crinkle Fries topped with their homemade chili and cheddar cheese sauce. Let me say that again in case some of you passed out just thinking about it. Legendary Runza Crinkle Fries, homemade chili, cheddar cheese sauce. Oh my goodness. It's a side that eats like a meal. So there you go. Another super secret menu item exclusively for Nick Bob Podcast listeners. So stop in, order the chili cheese fries and Runza. And while you're there, I'll tell them Nick Bob sent you. Okay, back to the podcast. He's that's what I was going to say. The one thing I will say, I not to take anything away from Damian, he is benefiting greatly from, he is pretty much fourth on the pecking order of who teams are kind of like putting on their scouting report of what they're trying to take away right now. And he benefits a lot, John, of like, he's almost always playing the four right now. Like, so he's getting such, it seems like almost every game he's got the best matchup on the floor, and he's torching people.
Especially in a one-on-one setting. Like if you got to attack a poor closeout or late closeout or with a ball reversal or something, like against UConn, Mitch Ballack had a little skip pass over to Damian Jefferson. He caught it and just went right to the rack. those types of situations he's just thrived in. But I've been impressed with his moves, his dribble. Like, he had a drive, jump stop, like quick finish on one play. I think he's shown the Euro at one point in transition, maybe. You know, he's just been really confident, I guess, with all the different ways that he's tried to attack the rim and score. And he's been really good on the block, like in the post, taking advantage of mismatches, maybe when they put smaller guards on him. Like, he's been efficient there. He's probably been their most efficient post-up guy. Though he's had limited opportunities compared to Bishop or Kalkbrenner, but he's been good on the block. So he's just been super consistent, and I think that that's something that Curtin has really needed, because we've talked about Mitch and Denzel Mahoney has had games where he's been really hot and games when he's been really cold, and Marcus Zagorowski's still trying to find his footing, and Christian Bishop's dealt with foul trouble at times, so is Ryan Kalkbrenner. Those guys on the bench have been injured at times. Like, Damian Jefferson's just been solid. Steady. Every game, you know what you're going to get.
Right.
And he's like, some of the things that his teammates have talked about, just his leadership, the impact that he's had with his voice, which is a credit to him, because he wasn't that guy. When I was at practice, you know, he was, it's not like he wasn't engaged, but he just wasn't.
Right. He wasn't barking.
And he's up that, and like when you watch games and you see shots of their huddles, or maybe it's in between a free throw or something, like, he's always talking,
right,
and always trying to encourage guys. So he's made a huge impact, and yeah, like, to this point, he's their MVP.
He's their best player right now. Like, he has been, you know. I don't think there's any doubt.
It's been impressive to see his transformation, because like
his. Yeah. You know, you touched on it, but like, he has improved so much in his decision making and playing off 2 feet in the lane. Like, it is every time
the jump stop.
It is drive, jump stop, and great things happen. Like he drives, he lands on two, and he's either able to you know, find a crease to get a layup, or he finds Christian or a kick out or something. Like, it's just he's so under control, and it sounds lame, but like, he is playing off 2 feet. Like, he is like Jalen Brunson or, you know, those Nova guys. Like, it's incredible. Like, he is putting on a clinic of the benefits of playing off 2 feet in the lane. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it's crazy too, when you watch, if you were to pull up games of his or clips from last year, 2 years ago, there's so many instances. I can remember saying this, and it's a little bit with Tyshawn too, because Tyshawn got better at playing with 2 feet last year before he left. It's like, oh man, if only you just jump stop there, dude.
Right.
Like, if only you just jump stop right there, because the defense was coming at you. Instead, he'd go off 1 foot and get a shot blocked, or have a really difficult play that he was trying to make. All of a sudden, you get on 2 feet. Their options are endless. And so, yeah. The coaches have preached that. I mean, that
you can tell.
That's,
I mean,
that's been a what do we call it? Do we call that a thievery, a steal, a sampling of Villanova culture?
Yeah.
Or Villanova style?
I mean, like you're in there. I think they have a drill called Nova Jump Stops. Like,
oh, right, yeah.
They work on it, you know. And I mean, even he had two straight drives. I think it was the UConn game where he had the same finish. And he's so under control and playing off 2 feet. He's not even doing Euro steps. He's doing full-fledged, like, crow hop sidestep into a jump stop. Like, here comes the help, and he is jump stopping
through it.
Through hitting a seam. It's just, and then he's so under control he can go finish. It's just like, he is putting on a clinic on how to be under control and play off 2 feet. Like, yeah, he's shooting the ball better, but to me, that's the part of his game that is like gone to a totally different stratosphere this year.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the play, one of those jump stops that he had where he drove baseline, I think, and two of UConn's biggest guys were right around him, and he just like hopped right through him.
Got an easy one
scoop layup.
And you could tell UConn was like, what happened? What? You know what I mean? They were like, they thought they had him, and he somehow jump stopped between two guys and then had the easiest finger roll you've ever seen in your life. And it's just,
I'm just like, that to me is, yeah. I mean, all those different moves that he's shown this year. I'm like, wait, I didn't know you had all this
stuff.
Where did you get all this? I know he's working really hard in the summer.
It
seems like something's clicked for him.
Oh, God. I mean, one of the coolest parts about basketball is when you can tell someone is totally in the zone and totally confident. And he just looks like he is drenched in confidence. Like the game is moving slow. He is just not even, he's not overthinking it. Like he is in the zone. Like, I don't think people understand how much this guy is totally like Neo in the Matrix right now when he's driving. Like, everything right. is happening in slow motion for him right now.
Yeah. And on the other end, man, like, now he's been pretty good defensively. I mean, he's got a lot of steals, so that jumps out. But he was amazing against Tyler Pauly
yes.
in that game. Like, he was all up in that guy's grill. And that dude, you know, he's like 6'8", 6'9".
Big guy.
He can put the ball on the floor and hit some step backs, fadeaways. You really just can't give him any room to operate. And that's exactly what DJ did. I was really impressed with his activity and just level of focus. And you can see, like, he understands the game. He's starting to see things defensively. One of the reasons why his steals are up, like, he's reading plays. You know, what did they call that? Shortcutting a screen?
Yep, he'll undercut.
You realize, oh, that guy's going, he's about to try to screen me, and I just jump over the top of it or something, or find a way to get around it. And then all of a sudden I'm in the passing lane, you know, he's just recognizing, whether that's film or just recognizing basketball and being aware. I feel like he's been really good at that too. So, yeah, he had some lapses against Butler. They all did.
Yep. They didn't play well.
They gave up a lot of easy stuff there. And the free throw shooting is something that, you know, he was 7 of 8 against UConn. So that's obviously a good sign. Like, he wants to, they need him because he's shooting a ton.
Right.
So, like, if he's going to go to the line, they need him to be better than, 56% or something like that. So, but he's been amazing. Yeah. Like, his growth, his transformation. Like, if Creighton wants to, they already can sell development and, you know, improvement to recruits, but like he might be one of their best projects in the history of the staff.
No, because I don't know. I think I might have told you this. I don't think there's ever been a player, really two of Creighton's starters. I can admit it now. I was very lukewarm on Christian Bishop and Damian Jefferson when they first got here. I was kind of like, I don't know. They're not overly skilled. They don't shoot it great. And it's just like those two guys. I've never had two guys at Creighton exceed whatever expectation level I set for them. And maybe this is my own fault, but like I've been blown away at what this staff has done with those two guys in particular. It's been amazing.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's probably unfair to Christian, but I've always kind of compared him to Cole Swider because just from a success standpoint, just because Creighton recruited Cole and Cole picked Nova. And then, you know, Creighton got Bishop in that class and they don't play the exact same position. Obviously Christian's more of a five for Creighton, but they were as recruits similar. And I always think about, you know, Cole Swider was this really highly rated guy who knocked down shooter, all this stuff. And I was like, oh man, he's perfect for Creighton's offense. And Christian Bishop, I'm like, well, yeah, maybe.
Right.
And look at that. You know, just sort of like it sort of is a reminder of how, you know, your assessments in terms of evaluating recruits as a novice and amateur like myself, like, what do I know? Like, give the coaching staff credit.
I think the other thing
recognizing, is I mean, they would have, I'm sure they would have taken Cole Swider if he wanted to come to Creighton, but they found a really good option in Christian Bishop, and they've helped him maximize, and he's done a really good job of being open to finding a way to be at his best at the five. Like, I don't think he signed up and said, oh yeah, I'm ready to go to Creighton so I can play an undersized five,
but right.
he recognized that's a need. And now let me see how I can use my strengths to help impact the team. And honestly, man, like, every time I watch an NBA game and I see, like, look, I don't know, Christian's got work to do to get there, but I see what NBA teams are doing with their fives, and I'm like, dude, Christian Bishop, you might have an opportunity here. There's some obviously some improvement. He's 6'7", and a lot of these fives in the NBA are 6'9", 6'10", but like, you know, Bam Adebayo, you know,
right,
like
right.
There's a new age five now.
Right.
And
yeah, you got to be able to
Chris
pass, hand off.
That mold,
yeah.
So
right. No, it's just, I think, a part of recruiting is forecasting and projecting, not who someone is right now, but who they'll be in 2 or 3 years. And I think that's where a lot of the good recruiters, you know, like if you're solely looking at a junior in high school and thinking about who they are now, well, I mean, that's a pretty short-sighted way of kind of looking at things. And clearly this staff was able to look at a guy like him and see what maybe other people weren't able to see, at least what I for sure wasn't able to see when I first saw him.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. You can look at every guy on this roster and sort of, you know, Marcus Zagorowski is another example. I mean, he was in the same class as David Duke, and,
right.
and the Jays were interested in recruiting David Duke as well. And if you ask me, I'd be like, well, look at David Duke, man. That dude's 6'5",
huge.
Like 6'5". A freak athlete.
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
Get that dude
right.
if you can. But Marcus Zagorowski, he gets here, all of a sudden it's like, wow, he's perfect fit. Like, what am I talking about?
I
you
know,
so
I know.
It is the sort of delicate nature of evaluating recruits, and they're not always right every time, obviously, the Jays staff, but they've hit a lot of them, and they found guys that really fit what they want to do, and they've worked around and found ways to help them maximize and adjust the system to them. Now I'm sure Creighton fans would, it's that recruiting philosophy thing is, it's just interesting because like I've heard McDermott say a lot of times, like we're going after speed and skill and, maybe like a savviness and IQ, and we'll take a hit. I don't know if he's necessarily has said this, but like the conclusion I draw from
right.
it is like, well, we'll take a hit in athleticism if it means we've got guys that are, can shoot, pass, and
right.
make good decisions. Like we can work with that because that's what our offense is built around. And then we'll figure out the other piece in terms of strength and development during their time on campus. Whereas other teams are just kind of grabbing the best looking guys they can get, and then they're
right.
saying, "Well, we can develop that skill once we're on campus." And so, different ways to go about it. But Creighton's obviously sort of mastered, at least to this point, mastered what it's,
they know exactly sort of, what they're looking for, man.
Yeah,
they really
what its
do.
Vision is.
Yes.
And it's been kind of interesting to see, especially now that they're in the Big East and it's the highest level of basketball that you can get, and yet they're still able to kind of find guys almost diamonds in the rough at times. But now, I don't know, now they're going to be elevating that recruiting.
I know now they're getting like top 100 guys and top, you know what I mean?
Classes
like,
is yeah. rated really high, and they've got guys though that I still think fit their system really well. So we'll see how it all plays out.
A couple more things I'll let you run here. How do you see the Antoine Jones, Alex O'Connell situation? And do you see that as a one or the other? Like, do you think Mac ultimately needs to kind of pick one and ride with them, or they can they kind of find a role for both guys?
I think they need them both. Because, you know, all of a sudden, with O'Connell out and Sharik Mitchell played against UConn, but he was still hobbled by that ankle, it's like, man, that rotation is thin. Jacob Epperson, you know, that he's battling a knee, and then, you know, there's no timetable yet for his return. So they were at like 10 for a minute there, and you're like, oh, that's great. But then against UConn, like, there's a chance if Sharik didn't play, and he played, but he's still hurt. Like, there's seven, still 7.5. I think you need these guys. And when Creighton's been at its best, it's gotten really good contributions from its bench.
Yeah.
And so their ability to – because they have – both Antoine and Alex have some athleticism and some playmaking ability that can give teams issues. I think – what they've struggled with offensively is kind of finding the right. It's sort of knowing when to be aggressive and when to. Maybe it's kind of like the Mitch scenario in reverse. Like
<Right.
laughs> we're talking about
yeah.
not being aggressive enough to score. Maybe at times those guys have been too aggressive to maybe not necessarily score, but just make a play when it's like, well, drive to the elbow, jump stop, kick it out, and let someone else kind of attack a defense instead of trying to. You know, feed this pass in between defenders or take this floater. Maybe you can just kind of keep the ball moving a little bit more. And then defensively, I think they're both still adjusting to, you know, that all the things that Creighton wants to do from a communication standpoint and being connected as a group. So, but I think there's room for both, because like Antoine's kind of played more the four, and Alex O'Connell's kind of been like a two, a three. So I think they can both contribute. And I think it elevates Creighton's ceiling if those guys can start being a little bit more consistent with their impact on games.
You know, because, yeah, I think, you know, Antoine is still just figuring out not having the ball stick in his hands offensively and all that, and some of the decision making. But at the same time, like, he's got 26 assists and 11 turnovers on the season. Like, you know, he still made pretty good decisions from a standpoint of not turning it over.
I did not realize that, because what's stuck in my head is like a couple passes against Butler,
right?
Maybe one against Providence. So
think about that, John. I mean, 26 to 11. Like,
yeah,
you know, good. It's. I think his poor decisions have been when the ball's just kind of it's not been as much turnovers as it's been ball sticking and some shot selection at times. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in Creighton's offense, sometimes a bad shot feels like a turnover because it just never happens. You know, they usually, like, when someone does force up a bad one, you're like, whoa, what was that? You know, like, that's it sticks out when you watch Creighton play. And then for, like, you could tell Alex is still just trying to find his confidence within the with feeling totally comfortable in this situation right now. You know, he showed flashes against St. John's or Seton Hall, one of the two games.
St. John's. When Zegarowski was out. Yeah.
Yes. And so, you can see it with both those guys. But yeah, when that bench is full strength, that's arguably the biggest difference from last year's team to this year's team. Like, they can bring in four guys that can really make an impact off the bench. And that really wasn't the case last year after Denzel.
Yep. Exactly. You know? And you know, riding the starters as much as they have had to do last year and at times this year, like, that's not a great. It worked last year. Don't get me wrong. Like, credit those guys that stayed in shape and avoided injury. You know, a little lucky, I guess. But yeah, that's not the recipe you want. And especially given what we kind of talked about at the start, the potential impact of Creighton's pace. If you give those guys just a couple extra minutes break, they can ratchet that tempo up even more and put the pressure on opponents. So they need those guys to be good. Hey, you mentioned shot selection. I feel like we should give some credit to Denzel Mahoney, because he's obviously been a guy who's like tried. He's kind of gone through it and tried to figure out what's good and what isn't, you know, in terms of what shots to take. But I thought he was really good against UConn, man. Yeah. Like, the shots that he took, he might have been 8 for 8 from he might have, maybe he was 5 for 5 on twos or something like that. Like, his twos, that's where he kind of gets in trouble at times. I feel like is what mid, because he's confident in his mid range J, but like when to take it. And I feel like he just had a really good, just a good pace to him. Like,
he's improved. Like, when you think about
under control in that game, and it was big.
Think about like the Arizona State game on the road last year, or the, you know, like Oklahoma, like he was coming in and shooting almost every time he touched the ball, you know, like,
yeah.
And then you contrast what you are seeing with him now, like, he has really grown in that department. And listen to it. I mean, we haven't even really talked about him. Like, it just goes to show you how I think what we both think of him is, like, we think so highly of him that, like, him leading the team in scoring, they were like, yeah, well, I mean, that's Denzel, you know, like, he's done a nice job this season in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I like that version of what I saw on Saturday. I mean, if he can continue that, because there's still been times when he's maybe forced it a little bit, and well, he got hot against Butler, so everyone was like, "Dude, force it, like,
right,
keep
right.
going," because we need you. But yeah, because like teams know he can shoot, so they're gonna try to put him on force him to make plays off the dribble, and he's just got to find that right balance of when to settle. And there were plays too where he started a drive, realized the lane was cut off, and stopped and pivoted and kicked it out or tried to find a teammate. And I thought those were just as impressive as like the drive to the cup or the one dribble pull up that he hit like in transition to break a 48-48 tie against UConn. So like, I think he's still evolving, obviously, and still learning, but I like that piece of, or that that version of Denzel on Saturday, I think that's if he can replicate that, that's a good thing for the Jays.
And then the other guy we haven't talked about is Ryan Kalkbrenner has been fantastic, all things considered. And like the way he's seemingly improved each game and like the impact, like Jays fans should be so damn excited about him being in the program right now.
He's perfect. Another guy that they found that's like now he wasn't off the radar.
No.
I mean, he had, I think Kansas offered. He was deciding between Purdue and Stanford, so those are good programs. And then Creighton. But he wasn't like crazy highly recruited or anything. I mean, he played on the AAU circuit or the Nike AAU circuit, so people knew him. But I'm like, how did you get this dude? Because he's perfect. Again,
he's awesome.
He's another guy that not only is so agile and mobile that can do a lot of the things that they want to offensively with their bigs, you know, putting those guys, putting teams in ball screen scenarios and diving to the rim. And he's got such good footwork, it seems like, and he's always under control. He's got some post moves. But what he does from a defensive standpoint, I mean, like, you would take a guy who has his offensive game, Creighton would take that guy as a recruit. Like, they'll be like, all right, we'll work with you defensively and try to figure it out. But he has potential to be elite as a big man defensively.
No question.
One of the best in the conference by the time his career's done. So, like, obviously he's a really good shot blocker. I think he's improving with his ability to read plays, and they're doing more things with him in ball screens, I think. So he's adjusting there. I mean, he's got to figure out that physicality thing. He's going to add strength, I'm sure, but he's got a good frame, like a good body. People say, look at him and say, well, he's slender, but he actually has like a good base to him. It's just like, yeah, he needs to get in the weight room and add some upper
There's
body
no doubt.
Strength.
Right,
like,
right.
I like his frame a lot. So man, he's been a nice piece for them. Like, I don't know where they'd be without him. Now that I think about it, like,
they've needed him because he's
in some a tough spot. So it like really valuable addition for the Jays, and he's been better than advertised. Like, I've been amazed watching his impact right from the start.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, he's only playing 14 minutes a game, and it's like, that's not that much. And man, you feel him on the floor. You just feel him. Like, he just provides two things that Creighton didn't have last year. They didn't have a guy that they could just throw the ball into the post to. You know, like, the only guy that could kind of do it was Denzel, and that's a different kind of pure post up. But they now have a guy that can throw the ball into the post to, and a guy that can, like you've pointed out, alter and block shots at the rim, you know? And those are two enormous things. Like, enormous things. And so,
yep.
He is I know that I'm sure you talked to the staff was really high on him. And so they kind of set the bar high in my mind, and he has exceeded it. I mean, I've just been so impressed with what I'm hard pressed outside of your Dawson Garcias and all that stuff. Like, there aren't too many better freshman bigs you see when you just kind of look across the landscape of college basketball. Like, he's really, really a good player.
Yeah. Like, Hunter Dickinson of Michigan comes to mind right off the top. Like, it's kind of maybe a different stratosphere.
Right.
I mean, okay, freshman in the Big East. Dawson Garcia, Posh Alexander. Like, who else am I missing? And, like, he's got a – Kalkbrenner is going to be on the all-freshman team,
And it's
right?
funny because I agree with you, but I feel like he isn't talked about a ton. I think maybe because Creighton's so star-studded that those guys cast such a big shadow that he kind of gets forgotten. But, yeah, I think he's an all-freshman team guy, you know?
Yeah.
But he just doesn't seem like he gets the run that he maybe you would think an all freshman team performer would get.
Yeah, right.
Sweet.
Yeah, no. Like, I was having a blast watching him. There's only a couple instances, but him and Adama Sinogo from UConn, that's another freshman, big guy, going at it at times on Saturday. I'm like, I could get down with this.
I'm
this is a little old
this,
school
man.
Watching
yeah.
these two guys go toe to toe and watch them develop over the next couple of years. That's gonna be fun. So, yeah, like. He may not. Yeah, you're right. He may not be getting a lot of. But if you're watching Creighton, you know the impact.
Oh,
and
boy.
So, I'm curious to see now if he hits a freshman wall.
Right.
I think
that
that's
kind
always
of that
a question
time.
With first year guys.
Yep.
Yeah, as good as they are, I mean, even Justin Patton hit a wall at a point in this like really impressive season, where he's freshman of the year in the league. Like, at some point, teams are going to figure you out and adjust to you. How do you respond to that? He seems to have a really good sort of level-headed approach, so I think he'll handle it well, but you never know. I mean, like a guy like Kyrie Thomas, they eventually couldn't play him, right?
Yeah, I mean, he eventually like, kind of lost his year. Yeah,
so,
right.
We know what he turned out to be, so like, I'm curious because they need him. Like, they need him to be that sort of, like Coach McDermott refers to him as the change-up to Christian Bishop. They have a little bit different style
completely
of game.
Right.
They need him, and they need that impact off the bench. So we'll see how he develops. But, yeah, I remember the coaching staff telling me he was number one on their recruiting board.
Yep.
When they started evaluating centers for the 2020 class, whatever that was, 2 years ago. And they were extremely really excited when he chose them.
Yes.
And then obviously once they got him in practice and got a chance to look at him, like the reviews were off the charts.
Yep.
But you're always kind of like, well, what does that mean?
And right. Then you never know until it happens in a game.
That's what it means. Yeah.
You know, I mean, okay. You just never know.
He's been really good for sure.
I'll get you out of here on this. I mean, where – I guess two things. Have you heard anything on makeup games with some of these, all the games that have been postponed or whatever? Like, everybody's used the term postponed, but I also don't know what that really looks like in terms of scheduling. You know, like, is Nova, how are they going to, is Nova going to try to play like a game every other day until the end of the season?
That's the only
way
it can happen.
How are they going to do this?
Because I remember I looked at it when they first started, it came back off their pause, and they had to do something like 17 games in 7 weeks. So that's like, you know, two games a week plus more, you know, somehow fit in three more games. That's to get to 20. That's unrealistic. Like, you just don't do that in a normal conference season, much less this season when games are still getting postponed. You could have all those games on the schedule and cram it in and still lose two at some point, and like, how are you going to make it up? So no, there's been no announcement in terms of what they're going to do. And I think it's just the assumption that everyone's making. It's like, nobody's going to get to 20. Like, that's just how it's going to be. So I don't know who that benefits or how it's going to all shake out. I mean, I wish, Nick, that college basketball would have been more innovative as a whole with its scheduling.
Agree.
I don't know. You and I might've talked about this at the start of the season. Maybe I heard you talking about it on your podcast. Like, they could have, it might have been more expensive, and it might have been, it certainly would have been more logistically challenging. But I mean, to run a season basically like normal during a pandemic seems, I mean, that's, they basically put themselves in this situation where it's just going to be potentially chaotic during the stretch run and into March, and who knows what's going to happen with the tournament. Like, I feel like they could have found ways to, like, the one thing I was thinking about was like, okay, the conference tournament, they obviously want to play that. They have TV deals tied to it. Ooh. Well, why are you going to play it like literally 7 days before the NCAA tournament?
Right.
When you put all these teams in one location and play,
you're
whatever
asking
it is,
for
10,
it.
11 games, and like increase the risk of exposure, whatever percentage that is, like it's not zero. So why not do that in mid-February? Like, put teams, like, you could even set it up like a bubble, and then suddenly you could, if you got eliminated from the main tournament, maybe there's a consolation ladder where you could still get games in and kind of push toward that regular season mark of 20. Like, I feel like there is a way to be a little bit different in how you went about it. And again, it's challenging. That's not easy. I don't have the answers from a financial standpoint. It's not like everyone's got all this money laying around, but they're going to be in a bind. Like, students are coming back on campus soon. Like you said, how do you fit all these games in? You can't. And what happens if one of your better teams, if you're the Big East, one of your better teams is on a pause in March going into the NCAA tournament?
Maybe, like, what a disaster.
That's obviously a horrible situation.
Right.
So, or what if Villanova wins the league like with a 7-2 record?
Right. Like, what do you
that
do?
Doesn't
you know,
feel right?
Like,
you know, so that could happen.
Right. It absolutely could happen. And but you're right. It is amazing how they've basically, like, let's be honest, they've done the season exactly how they always do the season from a structure standpoint. Like, it's kind of amazing that they have, nobody's really altered anything. Nothing. You know, and like, I do get nervous now. Students are, like you just said, students are coming back on campus. It's hard. I'm having a hard time picturing the NCAA tournament go off with zero hiccups, you know? And like, what do you do? Like, what if 3 days before the NCAA tournament, Gonzaga is out?
I know.
What do you do?
You can't, to me, it's your tournament. Like, why do you have to do it the same way you always do it?
I agree. I mean, like, I'm with, you know,
with
but then
team like Gonzaga, you don't want to like spoil. Like, I mean, it's a historic chance.
But then,
for a
but then the hard part is
for them, like,
yeah.
And we've seen how easily transmissible the virus is. You can do everything right and still get it. Like, I can't. We don't know all the details yet with what they're going to do for the NCAA tournament. I mean, there's some conversations that there could be some opportunity for makeup dates or stretching it out a little bit, but it feels like the structure is pretty much intact. So like if a team were to have a massive outbreak, like they're done. If you lose, you could survive if you only had one or two positive tests and you could isolate those guys and everyone else could clear and maybe you took a couple days off. But yeah, and that to me is unfortunate.
It makes me nervous.
That's what we're going to. And I bubbles suck. I mean, I heard from the NBA players, you hear the interviews, those guys, like, no one liked it. But if that's the trade-off to like avoiding the potential, you know, a positive test, like, do you think that players would sign up for that? Like, these NCAA players who are devoting so much time and energy to getting a chance to live out a dream by playing in March Madness, like, would they trade that uncomfortable, not ideal situation for a chance to be COVID free and,
I think,
you know,
yeah. Yeah.
May reach their potential? Like, I think they would.
I think they all
so
would.
What they're going to try it, you know, controlled environment and do as best they can. But I feel like one of the things I should do, Nick, and I'm kind of like, this is what I'll do in February, just kind of monitor. All right, here are the 70, 80 teams who I think are going to get in the NCAA tournament. Let's see how many are actually playing this week. Let's see how many teams are actually playing this week.
Good,
like, if you did that test right now, what would you have? Like 10 teams out?
Well, and,
you know,
and then the thing that, you know, we talk about, like, what do you do if Gonzaga's out? We'd be like, well, you could postpone the tournament until they're ready. But it's like, okay, well, then where do you draw the line on what team is worthy of, like, altering how you're doing things versus, like, oh, Gonzaga is okay. Hold on. We got to hold up until they're ready to go. Oh, Ohio State? Were they really going to do much? I don't know. I don't, like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what you do with this stuff. And
like,
if
Drake, what if Drake had it? You know,
yeah,
they got some positive tests. Like,
right, you go, Drake.
It could be a once in a generation season for Drake, but it's Drake. Like, what are we going to do for Drake? You know, so I don't know.
It's going to be interesting.
I don't know what the answer is. But
I just am nervous.
I felt like the best, like, if I were setting it up, and I get it, TV, this doesn't make any sense from a TV standpoint. There's obviously been, it's been proven that if you disrupt the normal window of when we as sports fans consume our sports, the numbers, the ratings go down. So, like, they want to stay in that traditional window. But, like, I thought it would be either push the tournament all the way back to May or do some sort of, like, bubble 2 weeks off, bubble 2 weeks off, bubble, you know, that kind of thing. So where you give yourself some leeway in case a team, especially one as proven as Gonzaga and with as much notoriety as Gonzaga and potential to win the whole thing, like, you don't discount them for just being unlucky, because that's what it's going to come down to. Somebody's going to get unlucky and miss an opportunity to have, you know, a memorable run.
Brutal.
So
it's gonna
I don't
be interesting,
know,
man.
Like, again, I don't want to act like I know the answers because I don't, but it just feels like this isn't the right way to do it. It might be the cheapest way, though.
Right,
it's probably the cheapest way.
Well, you're just hoping, and hope isn't a plan.
You're
just hoping it all works out, and you know we're in abnormal times, and to operate things normally just seems like, again, you're just hoping. And I hope everything goes off without a hiccup, but color me nervous when the calendar turns to March, what things ultimately look like here, man.
Well, we'll see. They've always talked about having these contingency plans, especially in the Big East. The Big East has talked about different options, regional scheduling models, or bubbles, mini bubbles, like 3-team, 4-team pods to get games in if things reach a certain point. But what is that point? Like, what actually prompts you to pivot? Like, what would prompt the NCAA to say, uh-oh, what we have set up, that's not going to work because it's February 25th and 15 potential NCAA tournament teams are on a pause.
Right.
Like, does it need to be 25? You know, does it need to be half the field? I don't know, but that's not there. That to me is going to be kind of curious to follow as well is like, well, what is the breaking point? And we may never know. And I guess hopefully we never
we don't know,
know
the answer. Right.
That means that it worked. And we'll cross our fingers because obviously we all love March Madness.
John Niatawa, Creighton beat writer, Omaha World Herald. Read his stuff. Get a paper. Go to omaha.com. John, awesome stuff as always. I kept you way longer than I said I would. I appreciate you, my man.
No problem. Always love talking hoops with you, Nick. Good luck on the podcast, man.
All right. My thanks to Pella. If you're thinking about a new window or a new door, now is the time. Check them out online on the web at PellaOmaha.com. That's PellaOmaha.com. And my thanks to my good friends at Runza. Best fries on the planet. Great burgers. Cheese Runza. Delicious. The food is simply fantastic. Runza makes it all better.
A Huda Media Production.